Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
This is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and online at WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer. We're going to take you on a musical journey of sorts this afternoon. A bit later on, live music in our studio from Erasure, kings of synth-pop of the 1980s, back with an acoustic set today. In the background, some music from India. Now, you might be familiar with the sounds of the tabla, the tambora, the sitar. These are instruments that often serve as live entertainment in many of New York's Indian restaurants. But before the release of a 1955 album called Music of India, Morning and Evening Ragas, the sounds of Indian classical music would have been completely foreign to most of us. Over a half century since, Indian music has impacted such famous musicians as the Beatles, Philip Glass, and John Coltrane. Writer and musician Peter Lavazzoli explores this phenomenon in a new book called The Dawn of Indian Music in the West. Peter, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you, John. It's wonderful to be here today on WNYC.
Now, you identify the dawn of Indian classical music here in the West very specifically. It's 1955 when the violinist Yehudi Menuhin brings Ali Akbar Khan to the U.S. How did that happen?
That happened because Mr. Menuhin had met Ravi Shankar in Delhi, India, in 1952, and Mr. Menuhin was on a charity tour of India after a very large famine that devastated the country in 1951. Prime Minister Nehru invited Mr. Menuhin to India because Yehudi Menuhin was already very well known as a Western classical musician with a great social consciousness, who would play for various causes in Eastern Europe, South Africa, and so on. So he traveled to India in 1952, and he encountered the music of Ravi Shankar, and he encountered Indian classical raga, North Indian Hindustani raga, for the first time. And he was absolutely astounded at not only the technical complexity, but the improvisation and the spiritual depth of Ravi Shankar's music and Indian classical music in general. So Mr. Menuhin developed a very close friendship with Ravi Shankar, and 3 years later, Yehudi Menuhin took it upon himself to bring Indian music to the West at a festival in New York, a Indian music festival with a concert at the Museum of Modern Art and a recording session which took place inside the museum.
And is he that, invited, was is that the recording that eventually became Music of India, Morning and Evening Ragas?
That's right. Mr. Menuhin had originally invited Ravi Shankar to come to New York in 1955, but Ravi Shankar could not come. He had some prior commitments that he could not get out of, so he suggested that his brother-in-law, who he had been training with, Ali Akbar Khan, the great sarodist, Ravi Shankar suggested that Ali Akbar Khan go in his place, and Ali Akbar Khan did, and Mr. Menuhin brought Ali Akbar Khan Saab to the Museum of Modern Art, played a concert, also appeared on a wonderful cultural variety show back then on TV called Omnibus, hosted by Alastair Cook. They did a performance on the TV, they did a performance at the museum, and they also had a recording session inside the guest room of the museum.
Now, in that recording session, Ali Akbar Khan, of course, played his sarod, which is an Indian lute. But Sir Yehudi Menuhin actually did a kind of spoken introduction. Here it is. This is actually from that 1955 recording.
I am particularly happy to introduce Mr. Ali Akbar Khan, who is one of the outstanding players of the ancient instrument, the sarod. I'm equally happy to introduce Mr. Chaturlal, the brilliant tabla, or drum player. The third instrument in our ensemble is the inevitable tampura, or drone. It is played here by Mr. Gore, a pupil of Mr. Khan. To help you identify our three instruments, we will start with the drone, or the tampura, which sounds thus.
All right, that is just a little bit of Yehudi Menuhin introducing Ali Akbar Khan and his ensemble to American and Western audiences via a 1955 CD.
LP, yeah.
LP, a groundbreaking LP called Music of India, Morning and Evening Ragas. We're speaking with author Peter Lavazzoli, whose book is called The Dawn of Indian Music in the West, subtitled Bhairavi, which is the name of a raga, Peter. What's the significance of that?
Bhairavi, well, actually, there's a couple of reasons why Bhairavi was chosen. Bhairavi is the name of a very popular morning raga. In fact, it is the most commonly performed morning raga. In fact, usually it's also performed at the end of an evening program. Many times an Indian classical raga performance will go after midnight, and so technically it is the morning. And in North Indian music, each raga is broken down into specific times of the day. So there are different ragas for the morning and the afternoon and the evening. And Bhairavi is the type of raga which lends itself to a lot of improvisational treatment. So it's very popular. And the other reason why I chose Bhairavi is because this recording that we just heard an excerpt of, Music of India, Morning and Evening Ragas with Ali Akbar Khan, the first raga that appears on the record, the raga that takes up side one of the original LP, is also Rag Bhairavi. So I wanted to find the name of a raga that symbolized a sunrise or a dawn, as with the English title, The Dawn of Indian Music in the West, and the image of a sun rising. But at the same time, the raga Bhairavi, which I think is a nice sounding name, Bhairavi, but it also happens to be the specific raga that was first recorded on an LP.
Okay. Peter Lavazzoli is with us, joining us from the studios of WLRN in Miami, Florida. We're talking about the beginnings of what has become a very influential stream of music. Now, in 1955, Ali Akbar Khan comes to the West, plays at MoMA here in New York. His brother-in-law, Ravi Shankar, follows in 1956, and then what? It's tempting to say then all hell breaks loose, but in fact it was kind of a slow trickle for a while, wasn't it?
Well, it seems that all heaven began to break loose. Actually, it's wonderful to reflect that now in the year 2006, Ravi Shankar is still on tour. He just finished an Indian orchestra tour through the West Coast in California. And later this year in the fall, he's going to be performing in New York and doing an East Coast tour. And the man is 86 years old, and I just heard him perform in San Francisco and Santa Cruz, and I can tell you that his level of accomplishment and his inspiration is still at the highest level. And the fact that Ravi Shankar is 86 years old and still able to tour and perform around the world and perform at such a heightened intensity is nothing short of miraculous. He is now on his 50th anniversary of his career as a Western touring Indian classical musician. He first came to Europe and the United States 50 years ago, and to me that's astonishing.
Right. Now, during those 50 years, I mean, we all know that the Beatles found their way to his music and were impacted by it in a big way. But before the Beatles, seems like the jazz musicians got there first.
That's right. Mr. Shankar came to the United States in 1956, and he began slowly building an audience, mostly in the beginning among jazz musicians of the post-bop school and the up-and-coming avant-garde school. And, of course, because Indian classical music is modal, which means that there are no chord changes, there's no harmonic changes like you hear in jazz or in Western classical music. In other words, Indian music stays in one key, and the entire musical content that you hear is melodic, and rhythmic, with the rhythmic cycles and the different modes and scales that are employed in these ragas. So for that reason, Indian classical music had a very special appeal to a certain kind of jazz musician that was beginning to develop modal jazz: George Russell, Miles Davis, and John Coltrane. Now, John Coltrane very specifically had a very strong interest not only in Indian music because of its modal character, and this modal quality allows for greater improvisation. When there's no chord changes, then it's more challenging and you have more latitude and more of a chance to really stretch yourself melodically. So Coltrane was not only attracted to that, but as a spiritual seeker, Coltrane had the kind of inquisitive mind that was always investigating different spiritual traditions of the world. Not only was he a very devoted student of the Bible, but he also read the Quran and he also studied Hindu teachings very closely, Ramakrishna, Yogananda, and so on. So Coltrane, when he discovered Indian music, and he discovered that through the music of Ravi Shankar, and when he discovered Indian spirituality, he very strongly identified with India as a whole, and he brought Indian music into the jazz realm in the strongest way.
Well, now, if you think of Coltrane's performances, for example, take this live performance of My Favorite Things that he did in Japan. This is, you know, a very familiar song stretched out to nearly an hour's length. I mean, it's almost raga-like in its epic proportions. What else do you hear in this kind of playing, not using Indian instruments, that shows the impact of Indian music?
Well, when Coltrane took My Favorite Things, he reharmonized it. He changed some of the chords. It's not strictly like a raga because there are chord changes. He does play the familiar theme. But My Favorite Things was the first piece that Coltrane performed on the soprano saxophone. And before Coltrane, the only other jazz musicians who had really specialized in soprano saxophone were, of course, Sidney Bechet, Johnny Hodges briefly in the Ellington Band, but then he went to focus on the alto, and Steve Lacy. But those players had a different, a bigger, wider tone on the soprano. When Coltrane took up the soprano saxophone, he more adopted the Indian tone of a very similar reed instrument in North India called the shenai. Mm-hmm. It's a double reed instrument played by Bismillah Khan. And Coltrane was listening to a lot of Bismillah Khan, and he incorporated that sound. It's a very dry, it's a thinner, drier tone on the soprano that gives it more almost like an oboe or a shenai type of sound. So Coltrane is not using an Indian instrument, but he is approximating the sound of an Indian instrument on both his soprano saxophone.
And it seems on the tenor saxophone in this live recording that was made in Japan as well, just a little bit of a 57-minute rendition by Coltrane and Pharoah Sanders and the rest of the band of My Favorite Things.
Now,
John Coltrane recorded live in Japan, My Favorite Things. We are talking about the Indian music influence with Peter Lavazzoli, who is author of the new book, The Dawn of Indian Music in the West. Bhairavi is the subtitle.
Now, I should point out that the excerpt that we just heard from Live in Japan came from a different aspect of Coltrane's career towards the end of his life, when he had that final quintet with Pharoah Sanders and Alice Coltrane on piano. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Coltrane was more exploring the atonal side of jazz. And that's quite a contrast from, let's say, like the original recorded version of Favorite Things, where he keeps it more into that melodic framework of the song with the soprano.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, there are other examples of the Indian influence in jazz, Bud Shank and, you know, all the others that you had mentioned
before. Well, John McLaughlin with Shakti and Zakir Hussain. John McLaughlin is really the next really outstanding influence there that I would cite.
The Beatles,
there's no question.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting. The Beatles actually arrived at that through the Byrds. which is an interesting story because when the Beatles were filming their second feature film, Help, in 1965, George Harrison, there's a scene in the film Help where there are some Indian musicians playing in a restaurant in London, and it's just a background scene. But Harrison noticed the sitar on the set during a break, and he picked it up and he started to look at it, and he became very curious about it. And then a few months later, when the Beatles were touring in the United States in August, this was right after they played at Shea Stadium to a record crowd in that 65 tour, they went to L.A. and they took a few days off, and they rented a house in Benedict Canyon, just outside of Beverly Hills. And they threw a party, and they invited their friends, the Byrds, to come to this party. So David Crosby and Roger McGuinn were sitting with John Lennon and George Harrison. They were, all four of them were sitting in a large indoor bathtub that was empty, and they were just sitting in there strumming guitars and talking about music. And David Crosby is actually the first rock musician who really became exposed to Indian classical music, and that was also by coincidence because the Byrds were recording their first demo tracks at World Pacific Studios in Los Angeles. That's the record label where Ravi Shankar was making all of his Western LPs at the time. So the engineer for the Byrds happened to have a Ravi Shankar album sitting around, and he said, "Hey, David Crosby, sit down and let me play you this. I think you're going to find this really interesting." And he played.
But first,
Crosby,
smoke this.
Yeah. And Crosby was already a big fan of John Coltrane and was already a big fan of modal jazz. So when Crosby heard Ravi Shankar, he immediately saw the connection between the two, and he said, "My God, this is just like Coltrane. In fact, this is the basis of what Coltrane does." So Crosby then took that enthusiasm for Ravi Shankar, and not only did he share it with the Byrds, and the Byrds began to use modal improvisation in tracks like 8 Miles High, but Crosby also exposed that to George Harrison when they had that party in L.A.
The little party in the bathtub. Yeah.
Yeah. Then Crosby said, "Well, George was asking questions," and he said, what should I listen to? And Crosby said, "Well, you should be listening to Ravi Shankar." And that's where that all began.
So now 8 Miles High actually quotes Coltrane, doesn't it?
Yes, it quotes Coltrane, but it quotes Coltrane doing an Indian piece of music.
So it's the Byrds quoting Coltrane, quoting Indian music.
Exactly.
All right, here's a little bit from the Byrds from their groundbreaking song 8 Miles High. Miles High by the Byrds. This song was actually banned in the mid-60s by some radio stations because of the use of the word high and alleged drug references and stuff. Peter, we're speaking with Peter.
It seems ridiculous now, doesn't it?
Well, it does, except that at the time it seems like, there were people who were sort of clearly and deeply inspired by this Indian music, but there were also people who took it on a more superficial level and for whom the whole kind of Eastern spirituality thing was a very easy fit with, the emerging drug culture.
That's true, and that's something that actually Ravi Shankar and George Harrison both went to great lengths to repudiate. George Harrison, it must be pointed, you're right. Many musicians, and I don't include David Crosby in this because I think that the Byrds were very sincere in their application of Indian music, but they were very eclectic, so they moved on to country influences and so on, but they were sincere about it, and so was George Harrison. But I think that there were many musicians who started to use the sitar just to kind of jump on the bandwagon, and of course, at that time, transcendental meditation was spreading in the United States, the Hare Krishna movement. There was a lot of aspects of Indian spirituality and culture that were catching on here in a very big way. So I think that a lot of musicians were tapping into that just to kind of ride the wave, so to speak. And then when the fad died out, then they just jumped right off the wagon.
Right.
But it must be pointed out that George Harrison was always so sincere in his search for spiritual fulfillment and his relationship with Indian culture that it became a lifelong pursuit for him. And his relationship with Ravi Shankar was a lifelong one.
Right. Now, what about audiences in general? Do you think they got it? I mean, you were at the concert for Bangladesh, right?
That's not true. I was just a toddler when the concert for Bangladesh happened. But I heard the live LP of the concert for Bangladesh when I was 5 years old. I was just beginning to listen to Beatle records from my parents, and they happened to have a concert. They happened to have a copy of the concert for Bangladesh when the record came out. Now, I had no idea about the concert. I was too young to read the newspapers and know about what was happening in East Pakistan when the war was ongoing. But I knew about the Beatles. I heard that live album, and that was my first exposure to authentic Indian music, because the concert begins with a piece, a Bangladesh folk piece called a dun. It's not a raga, it's called a dun,
right,
that is played by Ravi Shankar and Ali Akbar Khan with Alaraka on the tabla. And that was my first exposure to Indian music. You know, I heard some of the pieces that George Harrison had played sitar on, such as Within You, Without You from Sgt. Pepper, or Love You Too from Revolver. But I had never heard actual Indian music, and I was only 5 years old. Mm-hmm. I had the rest of my life ahead of me to hear this. But that was my first exposure, and I think that that's the same case for a lot of Westerners who had never actually heard Indian classical music. They heard it through the concert for Bangladesh because it was a very successful record. It won the Grammy for the album of the year, and for a three-record set, it went gold at the time, and that's quite a feat for a three-record set.
Right. So, I mean, despite all the fads, you know, there has been clearly a lasting influence of Indian music here in the West today. You know, you hear the tabla on TV commercials. It's a driving force in a lot of electronica. What do you think the most important, the lasting impact of Indian music will be? Is it something in the instrumentation? Is it something in the spirituality? Can you even divide the two that way?
I don't really think that you can. I think it's a combination of all of these things. But in the connection that you're talking about today with Indian music and electronica, particularly in cases like with Bill Laswell and Zakir Hussain doing tabla beat science, it's more in the actual sound quality of Indian music. It's more in the texture of the music, and it's more in the sound quality of the tabla that lends itself to that kind of treatment. And not only that, but it also comes back to again, the fundamental sound quality that Indian music is based in one key. It's modal. It stays in a drone. And modern trance music, drum and bass music, tends to be very repetitive, and it tends to maintain a very steady rhythmic cycle and repeat different patterns over and over again, which sends its listeners into a trance state. And this is very much closely connected to what Indian music does. Indian classical music repeats these rhythmic cycles over and over again. You know, a lot of this goes back to the way that minimalist composers like Philip Glass and Terry Riley began to incorporate Indian music into their repetitive minimalist music.
Hence, we have things like this tabla beat science record you're talking about, which have pieces with names like Sacred Channel. I mean, there's clearly that influence being acknowledged, not just in the music, but in the spiritual practice that it grew up with. We've been speaking with Peter Lavazzoli. His book is called The Dawn of Indian Music in the West by Ravi, looking back to a landmark 1955 record called Music of India. Peter, it's fascinating stuff, and we continue to hear echoes of that 1955 recording more than half a century later. Thank you for joining us on Soundcheck
this
afternoon.
Thank you very much, John. Very privileged to be here. Thank you, John.
Up next, your letters, and later, remember the group Erasure from the 80s? They were creating theatrical technopop then. Now they're back performing acoustic. We'll hear them performing live in our Soundcheck studio. Thanks for listening to Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Every day we dig into what's happening in music, and you can hear everything we do and check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. All of this is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.